Talking with Eleanor Stein, who teaches climate law at both Albany Law School and SUNY Albany, and she recently gave a talk at Bennington College about the issue of climate change and human rights. But I thought I'd start off with a question. One of the things you mentioned tonight, Eleanor, was the importance of the November 4th, 2019 date. Why is that important?
Well, that's today, and it's important because this is the first day under the Paris Agreement on Climate Change that a nation that was a party to that agreement can file its intention to withdraw from the agreement officially. And today the Trump administration, in fact, did just that. After stating on June 1st, 2017, that he was planning to do that, an announcement which triggered the formation of a group called the U.S. Climate Alliance, consisting of now 25 states that have agreed that they, or we, will maintain our obligations under Paris, Trump announced that the U.S. was going to leave. And under Article 23 of the Paris Agreement, that means that 1 year from today, the withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Agreement will become effective. And 1 year from today will be the day after the next presidential election.
So one of the things you also talked about was the issue that international, refugee law is not particularly great on protecting immigrants. How does the issue of immigration and the forced migration and, literally tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of climate refugees, how is the legal system going to try to respond to that, if all?
Well, right now, both international law and U.S. law has no provision for the protection of people who are fleeing their country because of environmental conditions or because of the climate crisis. And therefore, they have no special protections. So whereas people who migrate are forced to migrate from their own country because of political persecution or even because of certain kinds of political conflict may be eligible to be granted refugee status and therefore eligible for asylum. That is not true of people who are fleeing the climate crisis, even though their countries may have been basically rendered pretty much uninhabitable by the climate crisis itself.
Now, you said you didn't particularly like this quote, but you made the point that the previous century sort of was a key constitutional law issue with respect to issues of race and gender, and there's a need for this century to focus on climate rights as a constitutional issue.
And your question is, why don't I particularly like it? Well, I use it, and I think it has an essential truth to it, and it's a reminder of really the decades of fights in the Supreme Court in the 20th century that got us to a certain place with regard to women's rights and the rights of people of color. My concern is that, W.E.B. Du Bois said the 20th century will be the century of the color line. And you could say that the 21st century is the century of the climate crisis. And I just think, unfortunately, we haven't overcome the issues related to race, and we haven't overcome the issues related to gender. Unfortunately, those are still with us. And on top of that, we have the issue of climate change.
And you also made reference to the fact that, about two-thirds of the world's constitutions and legal systems have really, spoken to the issue of, a right to the healthy environment, the clean environment. But that the United States, which 30, 40 years ago was considered cutting edge worldwide on environmental issues, is really much weaker than these other countries in terms of trying to deal with the issue of human rights and the environment and climate. Why has the United States become so bad on this?
Well, in my view, there's a couple of major drawbacks to the U.S. Constitution. One, of course, has to do with its birth as an instrument for the preservation of slavery, largely, in the form of a document about liberty. But the others, the United States Constitution also doesn't grant any economic rights. So there's no right to make a living. There's no right to a living wage. There's no right to, have food on your plate or to feed your family. Many constitutions have those rights. And, of course, there's no environmental rights in the U.S. Constitution at all. Now, I will say, fortunately, that many state constitutions have taken on these rights and have them. Many of the state constitutions in this country have economic rights and have environmental rights. So we are relying on those largely.
So even though you, decried the lack of constitutional protection for human rights related to climate in the United States, you still seem to have a fair level of optimism that this, in fact, may be an important strategy. You talked about, New Zealand has recognized one river as actually having the rights of personhood, and the Netherlands have had some important court decisions or court rulings, and then here in the United States, the Children's Trust. So, what is your, prognosis or maybe assessment of the legal challenges here in the United States with human rights and climate?
Well, the first case that tried to link these two issues was the case brought by the Inuit of Alaska and Canada against the United States for the fossil fuel economy that has basically destroyed their towns and their countries and their livelihoods. And that case, they lost that case. And the next case that tried to raise these issues was the case brought in the Netherlands. And when that case was decided favorably, the court required the government of the Netherlands to be more ambitious in its climate aspirations. I felt that this was really a sign of things to come. And I wrote a law review on it to prove my point, because a lot of people felt that it was really just an aberration, and that we would never succeed on this human rights cases on climate change. But now there have been a number of them around the world, and people are using this as a tool, for one thing, for education of their own people about the depth of the climate crisis and why overall it's a violation of human rights in the largest sense. And I think people will continue to use it, and I think we'll lose plenty of them. But the fact that we've now begun to win some of them is a huge, huge step forward.
So what, if anything, can, an average person do at this point in terms of promoting the concept that climate change is violating human rights?
Well, I think that the most important thing for all of us to do right now is to put pressure on our governments and pressure on our legislators, pressure on the federal government to really transform our approach to climate change, to be responsible members of the world community. And any form in which you can do that is good. Being, on the back of your legislators, your local legislators, Congress, and maybe most importantly is being in the streets and being counted, standing up and being counted. So go to the climate marches, bring your friends, bring your children. First of all, it'll make you feel a lot better by doing something physical out in the streets to do something about climate. And secondly, we know from history that that is what makes changes in government, is just the overwhelming force of a mobilized public opinion.
Now, if people want to read some of your legal research, your blogs, or even just get more background information about climate change and human rights, what are some ways they could do that?
Good question. You can Google me, and a lot of my articles and talks that I've given are available online. I don't have a Facebook page, and I don't have a website.
Okay. And this has been Eleanor Stein, climate professor at both SUNY Albany and Albany Law School. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.